Are you looking for a reliable machine shop? Or maybe you need to find a metrology lab, or perhaps a service provider for scanning and reverse engineering? If you need to find vendors for your engineering or manufacturing project, visit vendors.teampipeline.us. It's free and helps you and your team find great vendors to help you succeed on your projects. You can also share a few of your favorite vendors with the community. That's vendors.teampipeline.us. Check it out today.
My goal is not to be the best leader of the team. My goal is to be the leader of the best team. The focus needs to be on the team, not on the leader.
Hello and welcome to another episode of the Being an Engineer podcast. Today we have the pleasure of speaking with and hearing from John White, who holds bachelor's and master's degrees as well as a PhD in industrial engineering. John's career has spanned over 50 years, the vast majority of that being spent in academics. He has held titles over the years, including, but not limited to, Dean of Engineering at Georgia Tech, Chancellor at the University of Arkansas, and Assistant Director for Engineering at the National Science Foundation in Washington, D.C. John, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Aaron, for giving me the opportunity.
All right. Well, let's start off with the same question I ask all of our guests at the beginning. What made you decide to become an engineer?
Money.
that was easy.
I'll tell you how it happened. I was a junior in high school, and I was taking a chemistry class. And Mr. Jones seated all of us alphabetically. So I'm on the back row, seated next to W.J. Wheeler. W.J. was a senior, and Mr. Jones asked, "What are you going to major in college?" Well, I hadn't really given that any thought, but I noticed that in that chemistry class, no one said English or history or philosophy or sociology. They all said chemistry, chemical engineering, dentistry, or medicine. Well, I have a sister who's 4 years younger than I am, and I thought it'd be difficult for my parents for me to be in med school or dental school. So I thought, well, I guess it's between chemistry and chemical engineering. But what convinced me was when it got to WJ, Dub said chemical engineering. So it came to me, I said chemical engineering. So I went home and I told my parents I was going to major in chemical engineering. They said, "What's that?" I said, "I'll let you know tomorrow." So I said, "Dub, what is chemical engineering?" He said, "Well, it has to do with chemistry. And in engineering, you make a lot of money." And I said, "That sounds good to me." And so I went home, told my parents that. Then they said, "Well, where do you go to major in chemical engineering?" I said, "I'll let you know tomorrow." So I'm like, "Dub, where do you go?" He says, "I'm going to Rolla." Well, I should have followed that up, Aaron. It turns out he went to the University of Missouri School of Mining and Metallurgy in Rolla, Missouri. 2,500 boys and 25 girls. And a year later, that's where I was. I was at Rolla. And then, being from Arkansas, at spring break, I went back down, took a couple of my friends to visit University of Arkansas campus. I'm walking across campus, and I said, "What's that?" And they said, "Girls," and I knew I needed to transfer. And so I transferred from my sophomore year to the University of Arkansas. And of all things, in chemical engineering, I had a fuel and gas analysis lab on Friday afternoons. But all of my fraternity brothers had dates and were going to the intramural football games. So I checked, and there was only one engineering major, didn't have Friday afternoon labs. It was industrial engineering. So I switched into industrial engineering.
Sounds like a very intentional path you took here, John.
Oh, well, listen, people would say, that is the dumbest way to ever choose a major. I agree with you. But what's really interesting, if I had it to do all over again, I wound up in the right spot for me. It really wound up being the best major for me. And so as I talk with students who are struggling over what to major in, I said, well, just, you know, try something. Just experiment. Go find something that really interests you. Well, when some students get up to their third or fourth major, you finally have to say, hey, get serious. You also need to think about graduating. So, but that's how I got into engineering, Aaron. It was really that way. My parents thought I would major in English. They really, my dad was an English, high school English teacher. My mom was an elementary school teacher. They thought I would be in the humanities.
Well, with the goal of girls and money, you could have got into rock and roll as well. That would have provided equally.
Well, that was coming along then too. Yeah, it's just crazy how it worked out. But
well, my story is not a whole lot different. My dad one evening at the dinner table said, "What are you going to do in college?" And I said, "I don't know." And he said, "You should consider engineering." And I said, "Okay, that sounds good." And that was about all the thought that went into it. And like you, it just it turned out to be a really great fit.
Yeah. Well, it, you know, I was good in math and I was good in science, and but I was also good in humanities. And that's but at any rate, that's where I wound up, and it was the right place for me. And interestingly, my son wound up majoring in engineering. His daughter wound up majoring in engineering. So it kind of, but now I have my daughter did not major in engineering, and her two daughters did not major in engineering, but it just seemed to fit. It was, and I love the whole engineering process. It's just something that I relate to. It's problem solving. I like that.
Well, you spent most of your career in academics. There was a period that I couldn't figure out quite. Did you go straight into academics, or did you spend some time in industry before moving back into academics?
I was in industry. I was at with Eastman Kodak, their chemicals, fibers, plastics division in Tennessee called Tennessee Eastman Company. And in fact, and I'm sure have heard and read many times Robert Frost, on the road less path less taken, the road less taken, that, you know, when you read that, it says, and I came to the, took the path less taken. Well, it says you make a choice. In my case, I started out in industry. And from then on, I did the best I could to keep one foot in industry as I went through the academic path. I tried, it wasn't an either or for me. It was both. I tried to find a way to do both. So through consulting, being on boards of directors of companies and everything, I wound up having a heavy, heavy involvement in business while I was on the academic path. Probably that's one of the things that differentiates me from a lot of the others who wound up where I wound up as head of a university. It's that I tried to keep really my focus on both business and academe as I went along. And then I had that opportunity to go and help with government for 3 years. And that really changed a lot of my thinking when I did that. It was the best 3 years of my professional career were the 3 years I spent at the National Science Foundation. Just completely changed my perspective. I had been all about me, my, and mine, and I got there, and I came to grips with the fact that the United States needed to do something to engage a lot more of our talented people in engineering and science, and especially the women and underrepresented minorities. And so I became a real advocate for increasing the participation of underrepresented groups in engineering, because you just can't leave the brightest half of our population on the sidelines. And frankly, that's the women students, that they have are really, really bright and capable. But you compare us with China and India and all, I mean, my goodness, we just were underrepresenting our women in engineering and science. We need to do something about it. So that became a big thing with me, and it continued that way as I went on to become the Dean of Engineering at Georgia Tech and then the Chancellor at the University of Arkansas. And when I was on the corporate boards, I would emphasize the need to get a diverse set of people involved, because the more diverse the team is, the stronger the solution is going to be for any problem.
While you were at the National Science Foundation, what were some of the initiatives that you were a part of there?
Well, in fact, I was the representative from the National Science Foundation for what they call the Fix-It Initiative, Federal Coordinating Committee on Science and Technology, focused on material synthesis and processing. And so I met with our counterparts in the other agencies and DOD. within also within commerce, with all of it. So I was really involved with that. That was one. And then the other thing that I got very much involved in was to get engineering schools to focus more on changing the whole focus of the engineering education to bring it more into concert with what industry needs were, to try to, instead of it being just a theoretically based curriculum, to involve industry in developing the curriculum within engineering. In fact, a number of people got really upset with me and said that, you know, I was fooling around with, I was taking the focus away from research and putting too much focus on education. But I just felt like that that was something that we needed to do, because the interesting problems are not just within the disciplines. They're at the intersections and the edges of disciplines. And that if you step back and look at it, there's a lot more that we have in common within engineering, the various majors within engineering, than there are differences. But also that we needed to get multidisciplinary teams, and we need to engage the sciences with us. We also need to engage the humanities and the social sciences people in coming up with the solutions. You know, it's I think that too often engineers want to only talk to engineers because we're more, it's more familiar. It's a easier thing to do when you're dealing with engineers, but we're a minority in the world. And I don't care how good your solution is, if it's not accepted by the people, it's not going to be something that will work. So I just was really focused on expanding the vision of that engineers have for how you develop your solutions, and to make sure that you had a diverse team coming in. And I'm talking not now just about age or gender or national origin. I'm talking about diversity even in the way that you think, the way you go about solving problems, even geographic differences. Because you get, if you look, talk with people from Northeast in the U.S. versus Southwest, they've got a whole different take on problems. So if you could get a real diverse team to come together, and then the key to it is, and be aligned with what your goals are, and that gets to what leadership is. You know, leadership to me is a process, which means that it's you're taking action. Leadership is not a noun, it's a verb. It's got to be action oriented. And then you've got to use influence in order to achieve those things you want to achieve. But then you've got to have a set of common goals that you're going after. And that's the common in that is the key. You've got to get the team aligned. And so achieving alignment in that is such a key for success, I think, within engineering. And we've got a long way to go. Unfortunately, if you ask a group of engineers to form a firing squad, too often we would form a circle. You know, we just have got to find a way to work together as opposed to working at cross purposes, and to get away from that silo approach and everything, and just say, hey, step back, cool it, listen to what others have to say. Just because they aren't educated the same way you are doesn't mean that they aren't, don't have something to offer. In fact, when I came back from NSF to Georgia Tech, and I was teaching while Dean of Engineering, and I had my son in my class, and I wanted him to hear his father say, look, if there are any of you in this class who believe that your abilities, capabilities in engineers are based on the color of your skin or your gender, I've got to help you get over this craziness while you're here in a protective environment of university, because when you graduate from Georgia Tech, you're going to go to work with and for people who don't think like you do, who don't look like you do, who don't believe like you do, who don't have any common experiences at all that you have. So we've got to get you ready to be successful in a world that is changing rapidly. So that's sort of what my approach has been. And it was the time at the National Science Foundation that changed my outlook on things, that I was stunned when I looked at the data. The data jumped off the page and said, the U.S. is in big trouble if we don't do something to engage more people in the enterprise.
And do you think that we've done something? How are we looking these days in that respect?
Despite all of our efforts, Aaron, and I mean, I worked so hard on that. We've made very little progress. Very little progress. We still have not been able to reach out and engage, particularly women and underrepresented minorities. Now, some engineering fields have done very well at that. Others, it's as though you just stopped the clock and said, no, we're not going to let time pass. We're going to just stay the way we are right now. You realize if you went and looked at engineering schools that award at least 100 engineering degrees a year, which engineering school has the highest fraction of women in their graduates? It's MIT. It's MIT. Now, they've been able to do it in a number of different disciplines. There are a number of their majors where well over 60% of the students are women in those programs, where at many other schools, that's not the case. Now, today, an engineering program is feeling really good if they get up to 35% of their students are women. But even so, you go back and you look at it, and you'll find for the engineering honor societies, the engineering professional societies, the officers, the leaders of those are disproportionately women students, that they rise to the occasion and they're providing the leadership, but still the numbers are really small. One of the things I did at Georgia Tech was I set a 5-year goals when I came in as dean. And when I gave the 5-year goals, people laughed. They thought it wasn't possible. Well, Alice, and through the looking glass, says the only way to achieve the impossible is to believe it's possible. And I believed it was possible. And I said, in 5 years, we should double the number of women getting engineering degrees. We should double the number of women faculty. We should double the number of Hispanic Latinos getting degrees. We should double the number of African Americans getting degrees. We should double the number of underrepresented minorities who are faculty members. We should double the number of PhD degrees we award. We should double the amount of funded research that we do. And we should go from being ranked 11th in graduate engineering by U.S. News and World Report to being ranked in the top 5 in 5 years. And they just thought it couldn't be done. Well, 1 year I declared it's the year of the woman engineer. And every meeting I had with the department heads, I'd go around the table and say, what have you done to involve women since we last met? And no one wanted to say, I haven't done anything. So they started doing things. And you know, at the end of 5 years, we did not double the number of women getting engineering degrees. And by the way, we were already awarding more degrees to women than anyone else in the country. But that's because we were the largest engineering program in the country. But after 5 years, 84%, we increased it 84%. We didn't double it, went up 84%. What about Hispanic Latinos? Went up 74%. What about African Americans? Went up 73%. We more than doubled the number of doctorates awarded. We more than doubled the amount of funded research. And oh, by the way, we were ranked by U.S. News and World Report 5th. And so I got a call from the provost congratulating us on we achieved it. And I said, Mike, if we had done what I said we needed to do on GRE scores, we'd be ranked 3rd. He said, can't you feel good about what you accomplished? I said, no, not within, it's within our grasp to be 3rd. I don't think we can get past MIT and Stanford, but we can go past Berkeley and Illinois. And then I left and went back to Arkansas as chancellor. And the report came out from U.S. News and World Report. And Mike called me and said, congratulations, we're ranked 3rd. We did it. I said, well, it's just you've got to believe that it's possible, Mike. And we've just got to stay focused on that. So
what are some strategies to believing that? You know, it's one thing to say, well, if you can believe it, you can achieve it. But it's another thing to actually have that mindset, that conviction that, yeah, this really is achievable. How do you enable that kind of mindset to where you really, truly do believe that something is possible?
Well, the reason that I was able to do those things is while I was at NSF, I visited all the top engineering programs in the country, and I saw what they were doing. and I saw what we were doing at Georgia Tech, and I knew that it was possible because others were doing it. So what I asked each of the department heads to do, benchmark against the top programs in the country in your field. And when they did it, they saw that these others were doing things they weren't doing. Then they got the faculty involved, and then they began to see it. And so having, I believe in keeping score, you know, and so I would do, I'd publish the data every year and show them what our goals were and how we were doing. And as you begin to see that battleship begin to turn, then suddenly what people thought was impossible now becomes possible. And then it goes to highly probable, and now it's happening. And so you need some evidence. And the reason that I didn't just make these goals up out of thin air, I looked and I saw what was happening elsewhere, and I thought, we could do it too. That's the thing. And so that's another reason I'm big on benchmarking, is that you look for best practices, you find others that are doing things, and so then you continue to look for things that you can do and that you can improve. So the continuous improvement gene is alive and well in me, and I try to make sure that's alive and well in those people that I'm working with.
Yeah, that's great. Well, you recently published a book on leadership called Why It Matters, Reflections on Practical Leadership. What was one of your goals for this book? I mean, why did you write it? There are plenty of leadership books out there. What did you want to add?
You are not kidding. There are plenty of leadership books out there. And so I had been teaching a course on leadership there. I had nine offerings of that course. And in fact, when I stepped down from being chancellor and returned to the faculty, some of my colleagues said, you need to develop a leadership course. And I said, I don't know how to do that. Every course I've taught has got equations in it. How am I going to teach a course on leadership? I don't think there's an equation about how to do that. So they kept after me. So I went to see my mentor, Paul Torgerson, who was at Virginia Tech. He was my department head, then he was my dean, and then he became the president at Virginia Tech. While I was dean at Georgia Tech, he was a person that I relied on to counsel me and advise me. And so I went back to see Paul, and I said, Paul, I've been encouraged to do a leadership course. He said, you should. I said, well, what book should I use? And he said, use Steve Sample's The Contrarian's Guide to Leadership. I said, Steve sent me the book. I had no idea that I should do that. Let me go back and read it. When I read it, I saw that he and Warren Bennis co-taught a course on leadership at Southern Cal. And so I called his office, and he was away. And I told his executive assistant who I was, that I knew Steve quite well. I'd known him since he was at SUNY Buffalo, and that I was interested in hearing more about the leadership course. She said, oh, well, there's someone who works behind the scenes with Dr. Sample and Dr. Bennis. Let me put you in touch with her. So she gets on the phone, and I introduce myself. She says, oh, I know who you are. You're the chancellor at the University of Arkansas, because I grew up in Fayetteville, and I came to the university when you came as chancellor. And I got my degree in sociology and came to Southern Cal to get my doctorate in sociology with an emphasis on leadership. What can I do to help you? And I said, would you send me the syllabus and everything about your course? So I went through and I took that, and then I changed it substantially to sort of emphasize the things that I wanted to try to emphasize at Arkansas. And so I offered it, and consistently over those years, students said three things about the course. It's the most demanding course I've taken. It's the best course I've taken, and it changed my life.
Well, what are some of the reasons that they liked it so much?
Well, and let me just finish that up, and I'll come right back to that. So the last offering, one student said, Dr. White said it would be the most demanding, and it was. He said it would be the best, and it was. He said it would change my life. It did not. It saved my life. And that's, Aaron, when I knew that I needed to do something about the book. Because in that last offering of the course, the kids in the class said, would you please write a book and try to capture in the book what's happened in this class? And so that's what I set out to try to do. Now, what happened there? Well, it met over 16 semesters. 15 of those, I had a guest leader who came and met with the class. So the first 20 minutes, I would sit there and I would have a conversation with the leader like you and I are having. Then I would turn to the class and I would say, do any of you have questions for our guest? Remember, we have two rules. What's said here stays here, and there's no recording of what the guest leaders say. Well, Aaron, of those 15 leaders, you could count on at least three of them being in tears as they responded to the students' questions about leadership. I remember a person who was on the Motorola Board of Directors with me. I asked, how do you balance family and career? He said, it cost me my first marriage. I had no idea. I knew his wife, but I thought that was his first wife. And he said, my second wife came out of industry and she understood what the demands are on a CEO. Another leader, when asked, how do you balance family and career, said, I'm the poster child in how not to do it. I'm a failure as a husband. I'm a failure as a father. No success at work will overcome failure at home. The millennials were very focused on how can I have a life and have a career? How do I do that? That wound up being an important part of the course, but it wasn't the most important part, I think.
I'm really curious. Was there an answer to that for these millennials who are, I mean, I think it's not just millennials, but a lot of us struggle with that question. How do we balance work and life? Were there any golden nuggets that came out of those discussions?
Absolutely. You take a person like Greg Brown, who's the chairman of Motorola. Now he's the chairman of Motorola Solutions and CEO there. His son was in 135, I believe, basketball games, junior high through high school. He missed one game, and that's because that game was rescheduled and conflicted when he had an appointment with the Prime Minister of Israel. And he wanted to change that appointment with the Prime Minister, and his staff said, it's taken us years to get this appointment. You've got to do this. Well, now, John Roberts, who's the CEO at J.B. Hunt Transport, his wife got with his executive assistant, put on his calendar what the important dates were for the kids, and he treated it like any other business commitment. When he came to class, he said, now, you may think I'm staying past 7 o'clock tonight, but my son's in a baseball game, and I'm going to be there. Okay? So there are any number of ways to try to work through that. If it's a priority to you, then make it a priority. But also how you go about doing it, if you're in a marital, spousal situation, it needs to be a group decision about how you're going to do it. Now, Shelley Simpson, who's the president now at J.B. Hunt Transport, her husband was making progress within the company, and she was. And so what did they do? She went to a cousin and brought the cousin in, and they paid the cousin as to be a nanny for the kids and all. And so you can find different ways to do it, but there's no cookie-cutter approach to this. I thought Steve Sample, in the beginning of his book, said leadership is situational and contingent, and he's absolutely right. It depends on the situation about how you're going to go about developing your solution, and it needs to be a family-based solution. Now, Donnie Smith, the CEO at Tyson Foods, said, I don't balance, I rebalance. My wife and I decided that we would build memories with our children instead of building mansions. And so we take them on extensive vacations and all of that, but they recognize that it's the sacrifices that they made along the way about me being available that allowed us to do those things. And they participated at the very beginning about saying, yes, Dad, you go do those things. Or then you take someone like Adriana Lopez Graham, who was involved with international travel and with Tyson Foods. And her children understood, well, mommy needs to go to China or mommy needs to go to Argentina or somewhere to make sure that the little children have food to eat. And so they felt like that any time that she wasn't there for them, she was out there making a difference for others. So she let them know what she was doing and why she was going. But then, you know, you work all kinds of hours in order to be there for the kids when you can. Now, on the military side, we had a Marine general and two Navy admirals who were guest leaders. And when they were sent, their children understood that their role was helping defend America, and they were right there. And interestingly, General Marty Steele, his son, followed him right into the Marines and so forth and understood that. But it's a thing that you have to communicate within the family and let them understand why we're doing this, what it means, and so that they don't feel like you don't care, because you do care. You care deeply about him. Now, my son, I worried so much about my son because he was consultant. He's right out of 4 million miler with Delta. And so he had two children, son and a daughter. He had acquired a company in South Africa. He acquired one in England, one in Germany. I mean, he was traveling all the time. But he made a point of every day he talked with his wife, because today with cell phones and all, you can do that. With social media, you can stay in touch with the kids. So he said he was going to build memories with his kids. He knew his son loved to hunt, so he's taken him hunting in South Africa. He's taken him hunting for doves in Argentina, black bear hunting. They go fishing every year, duck hunting. With his daughter, she loved Broadway shows, so he takes her to New York. They go to Broadway shows. They went to London to go to Broadway shows. He does that to try to make up for the fact that he couldn't be there all the time. But he said that when I'm there, they know I'm there. And so that's the thing that I think is so key in this, Aaron, is letting your children know they're important to you and that they're helping with this solution, because they're giving up time with you so that you can go do these things to allow you to do these other things for them. And so that's just the part of what came out of that class, Aaron. It was, we literally caught lightning in a bottle in that course. So now I don't think I've caught lightning in a bottle with this book, but I tried to share all of these learnings that came from these guest leaders coming and meeting with them. And oh, by the way, I contacted all the guest leaders and said, I know that when I invited you to come, I said that there'd be no recordings and what was said here stays here, but I want your permission for me to share these thoughts in this book. And so everything that's in there has been agreed to by the individuals that I've quoted.
Wonderful. Wonderful. Were there any, I'm sure there were a lot, but were there any stories or specific class sessions that really stood out to you as being particularly impactful that you can share?
Yes. General Marty Steele grew up in Fayetteville, where the University of Arkansas is located. Was an outstanding athlete in high school. He was a terrific leader. Came to the university and did not do well academically first semester. Dropped out of the university, enlisted in the Marine Corps. There's a book titled The Boys of 67 about three individuals who enlisted as privates in the Marine Corps and retired as generals. And Marty Steele is one of those. He goes in the Marines, immediately sent to Vietnam. Best friend dies in his arms. He's given a battlefield promotion to corporal. He was chosen by the staff sergeant, really. Picked him out and said, he's got to go to officer candidate school. At that time, you couldn't go to officer candidate school if you hadn't graduated from college. That made an exception for Marty, and he went. He became the longest serving chief operating officer in the Marine Corps. When he retired, he became the executive director of the museum on the Hudson River, the Intrepid aircraft carrier there. On September the 11th in 2001, he was out on deck with one of his aides. He looked up and he saw a plane coming up the river. He said, that's going to be a terrorist attacking the World Trade Center. Call the FBI and tell them they can stage here on the Intrepid. Now, how did he know that? He had been giving testimony before a Senate committee about what their intelligence said was going to happen. A senator called a recess, took him outside and said, look, stop talking about that. You're going to scare the American public. Well, on September the 12th, that senator called Marty, apologized and said, I should have let you keep talking. He said, it's too late now, Senator. Well, as Marty would meet with that class and talk through the challenges and things that he faced, you could drop a pin in that room and hear it drop. I mean, he had those students understanding. that leadership can mean the difference in life and death in situations. And his times with the class were always impactful, but so were several of those from other leaders as well. Greg Brown was just brutally honest with them, just laid it out there and talked about the struggles that he had with depression and all, and then how he was able to deal with it and what happened. And so all of these kinds of things are shared with the class, and then wound up, I'm able to share them in the book.
Amazing. Thinking back on your own career, being in leadership for so long, what are a few of the biggest triumphs that you feel you've had as a leader? And then conversely, what are a couple of the worst mistakes that you've made as a leader? And how can we learn from that?
Well, let's start with the mistakes, because there were so many of them. I mean, in fact, I address some of those within the book, but also when I finished the manuscript, in order to publish that manuscript, would have doubled the size of the book. So I had to face reality and reduce half of it so that the half that's not in the book is out there on a website that I have now that's a companion to the book. But at any rate, a big mistake I made right off the bat was listening to the wrong people. Well, I didn't know they were the wrong people, but the person who was going to be my chief financial officer I met with before I became the chancellor at the university, is between the time it was announced I was going to be it and before I actually started, and learned that we had a major budget problem with the University of Arkansas Press. And it was losing a lot of money, and it built up a significant debt. And then I had the president of the system and some trustees were saying, you're going to have to close the University of Arkansas Press. So I put this off as long as I could at dealing with it. But then in the spring, we had budget hearings to focus on the next year's budget. And when I asked the head of the university libraries that if it was not the University of Arkansas Press, how many of their books would he purchase for the library, when he said not any. And I knew that we also had a major shortage of funding for the library. I called the University of Arkansas system president. I said, I've concluded I need to close the University of Arkansas Press. And he agreed. And he said the trustees would understand and they would support me on it. So I went over and met with the University of Arkansas staff and told them we were going to have to close the University of Arkansas Press. Of course, they were devastated. And then, Aaron, it hit the fan. I mean, every newspaper in the state dealing with freedom of the press, the Chronicle of Higher Education had a big article about closing of University of Arkansas Press. President Jimmy Carter called me because University of Arkansas Press had been publishing his books for him. And I mean, the pressure was building. So, and it was building on the trustees, and they began to put the pressure on the president. He called and he said, you're going to have to reverse your decision. I said, Alan, this is the first big decision I've made. And if I have to reverse this one, then people are going to know the way to get decisions reversed around here is put pressure on the trustees and pressure on you. He said, you just got to do it. And I held off. I just wasn't going to do it. I was going to just stonewall and not do it. I was going to be stubborn, Aaron. I mean, I really was. I was going to dig my heels in, for goodness sakes. And then Don Tyson of Tyson Foods came to my rescue. He gave $1 million gift to the University of Arkansas Press. He gave me a way out. He gave me a loophole I could explore. So now I could announce, because private support has come forward, we're going to keep the University of Arkansas Press open. We then reorganized it, changed who the head of the press was, changed the reporting relationships, did all of that, and the press has done fine since then. So what I didn't recognize was what the other stakeholders, the people who were deeply invested in the press, like my predecessor as chancellor, my predecessor's predecessor as chancellor. The relationship that the head of the press, who was teaching President Carter how to write poetry, that relationship, I hadn't even thought about the notion of freedom of the press. I forgot that the Chronicle of Higher Education makes its money off of job ads as well as book ads, and there that there were going to be all of these folks going to come. Right off, I should have learned the law of unintended consequences, that I should have recognized that old engineering principle that says, for every solution to a problem, there's a new problem. Or why didn't I remember Newton's third law? For every action, there's an equal and opposite reaction. Why didn't I recognize that there's going to be a second bounce to the ball? Why couldn't I look ahead and say, surely there's some other people who are going to favor keeping it open. Maybe I should hear from them. The only inputs I was getting were those who were saying it needs to be closed. Well, I don't care how thin the pancake is. There are two sides to the pancake. And I didn't bother to look for the other side. I thought I knew exactly what I needed to do. How stupid was that? I ignored everything I had been taught. I completely forgot about Newton's third law. Now, come on. Give me a break. Now, but did I learn from that? Oh, no, no. I made other mistakes just like that next year and the next year. I mean, come on. What is it about you? Thicko, come on. Get with it. You've got to look for people who think otherwise. Get different opinions. If everybody is on the same wavelength on something, you're in trouble, because there's going to be somebody out there whose input you've not gotten. And you ought to get it and then think about it.
That's a big lesson. Yeah. To look for feedback, not just from the people who are kind of saying the same thing that you are, but from the people who are opposing those opinions.
And that's another real argument for why you need to have a diverse team. And yeah. In fact, Marty Steele, he made sure that all of his teams, he was real big on the Myers-Briggs personality assessment tool. He made sure the teams that he had represented all the combinations of personalities. That's why J.B. Hunt, that Shelley Simpson, who's real big on StrengthsFinder, makes sure she goes through and she knows what the strengths are for all the members. And she puts together teams to make sure that she's got strengths where others are weak. And that's the key, is that every leader needs to be brutally honest and understand what her or his strengths and weaknesses are, and make sure you are surrounded by people who are strong in areas where you're weak. And if you go into it thinking you've got all the answers, hey, you're in big trouble, because what your responsibility as a leader is to have all the questions, not all the answers. You got to be asking and asking and asking, and make sure you're asking over a broad cross-section of people. The diversity issue, again, rears its head and says, get people of not of like minds, of unlike minds, get unlike minds in the room. We don't want Tweedledee and Tweedledum as our people that are helping us make the decisions. We need more than that.
Well, it occurs to me that really what we're talking about here is communication and how to keep the lines of communication very much open between different groups. What are a few kind of foundational truths of effective communication that you've learned over the past 50 years as a leader?
I wish I had learned them sooner, Aaron. And the first one is the one we've been talking about. It starts with listening. It starts with listening. And I didn't listen as well as I should have. I didn't listen as broadly as I should have. I didn't listen between the words and behind the words. I didn't listen to the body language that was there at the time that the verbalization of the words was occurring. I needed to listen better. And I'm talking about being an active listener. I mean, really, really listening, trying to get inside the head of the person you're listening to understand what that person's really, really saying. Because, I mean, the biggest problems that I've had are issues of communication. And yet, people would say, I'm a great communicator. No. first of all, there are not any really great communicators out there. We think we are, maybe. We can give speeches. We do a lot of communication, but it's mostly we've pushed the send button, and sometimes people don't even have a receive button they could push. And that's the biggest complaint that I've heard on leaders, is that they don't listen. They just are telling all the time, telling and telling, but they aren't listening well. So start with listening. And the next thing on that I would say is know your audience really well and speak the language of the listener. You've got to be able to speak their language. You can't go through and just be talking finance lingo or engineering lingo if you're dealing with non-finance or non-engineering people. You need to be able to speak their language. Put it in terms they'll understand. That's one of the reasons that I rely so heavily on stories to communicate. When I was asked during the interview process for Chancellor what my leadership style was, I said, I believe in kudzu management. And they had no idea what I was talking about. Kudzu is a plant that was brought to the U.S. from Japan that was put along the railroads in the South to combat soil erosion. But you can go down now, and if you drive from Texas across Arkansas, on across Mississippi and Alabama, even across Georgia and into South Carolina, you can see kudzu growing out there. Now, you actually can't see it growing, but if you turn your head and look back, it will have grown. I mean, it will just cover an abandoned house. It covers trees. Now, I told the staff, I said, look, I'm an externally focused minister. I'm going to be gone a lot. And the more I'm gone, the better university is going to be. So I'm depending on you to be running your parts of the organization. But keep me informed, and I don't like surprises. I don't believe in shooting the messenger unless the messenger doesn't deliver the message, both the good news and the bad news. So keep me informed. But you won't see the differences day to day or even year to year that's going to occur here. But after 5 years, you're going to see we've made a lot of progress. And after 10 years, you're not going to believe it. It's going to be phenomenal progress because I'm going to stay the course. We're going to continue to persist and persist and persist until we accomplish what we're setting out to accomplish. And so that's one of the things that it didn't take long for people to recognize that I'm often pleased but never satisfied. I believe we can always do better. And I'm a big advocate of setting lofty goals. When I gave the high school commencement address, I used a quotation from Thoreau: if you built castles in the air, that's where they should be. Now put foundations under them. So I set big, hairy, audacious goals, as Jim Collins called them. I believe that we could raise $1 billion in private funding at the University of Arkansas. And no one else believed that but me. And we wound up raising over $1 billion in private support. When the North Central Association, which is the accrediting body at the University of Arkansas, they come every 10 years to do an assessment on the university, and they were there just before I started. And then they came 10 years just as I was nearing the end of my time as chancellor. And they said they had never seen the kind of transformation that had occurred at the university in a 10-year period. Why were we able to do that? Because we were able to achieve that alignment of getting focused on what our goals were, the processes by which we were going to pursue those goals. And we persisted and stayed after it. And we got a lot done in those 10 years.
That's a great reminder of how powerful focus can be. I have a quote here on my wall that says, success is not difficult. It merely involves taking 20 steps in a singular direction. Most people take one step in 20 directions. I think that's kind of what you're saying right now.
Absolutely. And one of the things that I've said that really shocked some people when they first heard it, I said, my goal is not to be the best leader of the team. My goal is to be the leader of the best team. The focus needs to be on the team, not on the leader. If you're focused on the team and the team does exceptionally well, then you're going to get credit for it as the leader of that team. But your goal shouldn't be, I'm going to be the best leader of the team. No, no, no. It's I'm going to be the leader of the best team. What's in the best interest of the team members to help them be successful? And if they know that you are behind them 100%, they're going to do extraordinary things.
I like that a lot.
Sam Walton had a sign over the door going in and said, through these doors are ordinary people coming to do extraordinary things. And ordinary people can do extraordinary things. When you get them put together as a team and focused on that goal, you can achieve tremendous amount.
Well, John, I think maybe just one more question here, then we'll wrap things up for today. And we've probably covered some of these already, maybe a lot of them, but let me ask this question again, kind of in a different way. What are a few things that you know now about leadership that you wish you had known as a young leader just getting started? Things that perhaps folks listening to this right now can take advantage of?
Well, the one was about listening. To listen first. The leader should speak last, not first. You should listen. You shouldn't be the first to speak when you go in to say, you know, you should listen to people. And that when you are asked a question, you don't give an answer. You turn it around and ask a question. You use it as a learning opportunity for the team. That you're not the person. You're not. If you are the smartest person in the room, you're in big trouble. You didn't assemble a very good team. Okay, so you need to get people who are strong where you are weak. I was on a plane flying back from New Orleans to, when I was on the faculty at Virginia Tech, flying from New Orleans to Atlanta, and then changed planes to go on into Blacksburg. Seated next to me was the world's number one handball player at the time. He asked me if I played handball, and I said, no, I have a reoccurring dislocation left shoulder. I play racquetball. He said, I'm going to give you three bits of advice. If you follow them, it's going to really improve your game. Number one, play with people who are better than you. Number two, play to your strengths, which is probably your forehand. So hit every shot to your opponent's backhand. Focus on your play with better. Focus on your strengths, and then hit every shot to that, attack your opponent's back end. Well, Tommy Carpenito was a graduate student that was working with me. He was a linebacker on the football team. Smart guy, really smart. He was smart enough to let me think I could compete with him in racquetball, but he always beat me like a drum. So I went back and I thought, okay, I'm going to hit every shot to Tommy's backhand. Every serve, every shot. I won the first game. I had never won a game from him. Never had. I'm in the second game, and I've got him 10-0, and I did a little baby lob to his backhand. He missed it, smashed his racket against the wall of the court, walked off the court, and never played racquetball with me again.
Brilliant. Oh,
well,
what a great story.
I had no idea how those three things would influence my leadership.
Now, hold on. I heard two of the three things. I only heard two. One was focus on your strengths.
No, well, first was play with people who are better than you, okay? Mm-hmm. And then focus on your strengths and attack your opponent's weakness, which is usually their backhand, okay? Those were the three. So first, play with people better than you. When I came back to Georgia Tech as dean, I said, there are several things that bug me. One is that we keep saying we're the best engineering program in the South. I am not going to be content with being the best engineering program in the South. I want to be the best in the world. I mean, you can go to our bookstore and buy T-shirts that says Georgia Tech, the MIT of the South. I'm not going to be happy till I can go to MIT and buy a T-shirt that says MIT, the Georgia Tech of the North. I said, we're going to go after this. And so then we did benchmarking. In other words, to play with people who are better than we were. We had to understand our strengths. So we went through to identify where were we, so we would make sure that the budget, we would put resources in. I believe in pouring gasoline on live embers, not dead coals. Okay. And then we would not I didn't like that Tommy never played again with me. I thought maybe attacking your opponent's weakness isn't the way to do it. Maybe we should just keep emphasizing with people what our strengths are. Now, occasionally I might point out an opportunity for improvement in my competitor, but I'm not going to go attacking them and not going to be that negative. Thank you very much. So I think that the things that I would leave is to understand your strengths and play to your strengths and understand the need to have that diverse team. I wish I had known that early. I thought that I was the leader. Oh, I've got to have all the answers. No. It's not the way it works. I also didn't understand the notion about servant leadership, that your whole focus is serving those whom you lead, as opposed to them serving you. It's selfless leadership, not selfish leadership. And so those are the things that as a young person, I wish not only that I had heard and understood, but that I had practiced. No, I think that too often we don't do the things we know we should do. And one of the things for sure that I learned along the way is although I am an engineer, there comes a point where paralysis of analysis comes into play, and you have to say, good is not the enemy of great. There are times when good is good enough, and know when to settle for getting less than perfection because you need to move on to the next opportunity. I was such a perfectionist early on. It took me a long time to learn that I need to compromise. When someone, in fact, my leader at one point said, John, you need to learn how to go along to get along. And I said, I'm not a go along to get along kind of guy. Well, as I thought about that, what I understood him saying was, I needed to not be so perfectionist. I needed to learn how to compromise. I needed to learn that not all problems are technical problems. If they're technical problems, they're easy to solve. But if those problems are what Ron Heifetz in his book, Leadership Without Easy Answers, called adaptive challenges, then those kind of problems, you need to have the people who are impacted by the solution create the solution. It shouldn't be a top-down kind of process at all. It should be almost a bottoms-up kind of a process. It took me a long time to learn that, Aaron. I think that engineers and also scientists and accountants, we tend to see things as black and white. We are not real good at finding the gray in there. And I think that right now in this nation, and in fact in this world, with the polarization that's going on, we need to understand that when you've got a polarity, it's not a problem to be solved, but it's a opportunity for reconciliation and listening to both sides, and both sides need to listen and to find middle ground. And that's where I think engineers, we need to always be looking for that middle ground out there, because we want our solutions to be implemented and used. It's not going to be great just because it's the most fantastic. It should be a Nobel Prize winning solution if it's not accepted by the people.
John, powerful words. You have sure made my job easy today. What a delightful 60 minutes this has been. Are there anything else that you'd like to say before we sign off here? And also, maybe you can share a little bit about where people can go to find and purchase your book.
Oh, my. Well, if you go to my LinkedIn, connect with me on LinkedIn, and that's the place where engineers tend to really get together through LinkedIn, then there's a lot of information there. Or you can go to my website, which is John A. White Jr. That's JohnAwhiteejr.com/WhyItMatters. then there's going to be information there about how you could get the book. And there's also information there that didn't make its way into the book. And if you get the book, then you see on page 287 is a password that takes you to a restricted section on that website that then gives you all this other stuff that those guest leaders were sharing with the class along the way.
Oh, wonderful. Well, I'd buy it just for that.
Well, thank you.
Thank you so much for sharing all this with us today. This was a powerful episode. And like I said, you really made my job easy. So thank you again. Thank you for being with us. And I sure appreciate your time today.
I'm Aaron Moncur, founder of Pipeline Design and Engineering. If you liked what you heard today, please share the episode. To learn how your team can leverage our team's expertise developing turnkey equipment, custom fixtures, and automated machines, and with product design, visit us at teampipeline.us. Thanks for listening.